Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
My guests today are Groove Armada. From their roots in raw house and 90s rave to establishing one of London's biggest music festivals, playing iconic live shows in the world's best venues, releasing 8, soon to be 9, studio albums, selling millions of records and numerous Brit and Grammy nominations, there's not a lot they haven't seen or done on the dance scene. Andy and Tom, welcome! So I'll give you some background on why I started this podcast. I know that, Tom, you've just listened to the Pete Tong episode, but generally, the reason why I started doing this in the first place was being born in 94, when I started raving when I was 18, I felt like there was all of these stories that I'd heard of other people's rave experiences, that there was something now missing when I went raving. So what's been fascinating for me is talking to people. I've had a lot of mixed reviews. You'll have noticed in the Pete Tong one, his opinion actually differs from a lot of other people. A lot of other people have said, no, rave is forever changing. There's all sorts of different stuff happening with rave now that you didn't get 20, 30 years ago. But then I think Pete was the kind of like the first one to be like, actually, I have noticed a difference and I don't think it's for the better. Obviously, technology and the way music is consumed is completely different now to it was even when I started in the music industry, let alone 20 years ago. But we will get onto all of that. First of all, I would really like to know how it all started for you guys.
Tom in Cambridge had been part of the what was a Cambridge sort of funk and soul scene that went on to, you know, likes of Tim Lovely and DJ Harvey and all that. But he can tell you more about that if you want more info on that. Meanwhile, I was up north at the beginning of things like sort of pre Back to Basics parties in Leeds and Manchester and stuff like that. So early rave stuff. And then alongside that, I was playing quite a lot of jazz and blues as a, you know, what my mum and dad would call proper music. And and so by the time I started going out with the lady who's now my wife, who was at school with Tom, and she suggested that we should meet up, I was sort of down the house road and Tom had a bedroom full of funk and soul records. And that's where we met. In fact, is in a totally platonic way, of course, in Tom's bedroom in his mum and dad's house in Cambridge.
So do you guys play proper instruments then? What instruments do you guys play?
I play the piano and the trombone and the bass guitar.
And how old did you start doing all that from?
Oh, I started out very young because my dad was a trombone player, so I was sort of sitting at the piano from when I could sit up, really. So I did all the grades and all that kind of caper, and then someone took me out one night and I heard Sasha playing, and that was that.
And Tom, what about you?
Yeah, I mean, Andy's definitely more than a musician, but I did play the trumpet and the piano quite badly, although I enjoy playing that now. And the bass guitar is the main one that I played in funk bands. So I was more like my hero was a guy called Bernard Edwards, who was the sort of bass player for Chic and Sister Sledge. I think Andy's hero was more Mark King, man, like to slap his face. I like to more so give it to a bit of a nice heavy pluck. But yeah, bass guitar is the thing that I play with in funk bands and still play. Both of us still play on stage now. You'll see both of us handing the bass to each other from time to time. So there you go.
Has it been really important to keep that instrumentation, the live instrumentation feel throughout your careers and in your music?
Yeah, it has. I mean, I think that we, as I said, when we first met, we were just talking about that. Andy was saying how he came up to my my attic in Cambridge. And yeah, we were both playing and we were both bass players. That was the sort of thing that I really got into. And when I go back, when you were doing that intro just now, and I was kind of, you were compressing our career into 20 seconds and, you know, remembering some of that stuff and setting up Love Box and the Grammy nominations, lots of nominations, no awards, but there you go. I do really remember, but the live thing, that being so central to what we do and, you know, us being, you know, making sort of live dance music, that coming together of live instrumentation and technology and something to make sense of club heads was something that was really central to who we were, you know. And you know, I think that's been really key for us. And obviously in terms of big tunes that we've made over the years, then, you know, the first breakout tune for us is probably Out the River, and that's very much a live piece of music, and that's Andy on his trombone. We can talk more about that later because there's good stories about that tune too.
So what made it? What made you two fall in love with each other musically, of course?
Oh, crikey. Well, it's Andy's turn, so you're going to have to tell me first.
Yeah, I mean, well, basically what happened was we got to know each other and then we moved to London, and then with a couple of mates, we started putting on a club night because, you know, like lots of people moving to London. Tom had been DJing up in Manchester. I've been DJing up in Leeds and around Oxford. Mm. And you get to London, you can't get any work because there's too many DJs and not enough clubs. And so we started trying to put on our own night, which was called Captain Sensual at the helm of the Groove Armada. And that's obviously where the name came from in the end, when we decided to shorten it down to save on printing costs. And
so is that why?
That's why, yeah. So we put on these nights in the most random places, and some of them worked and some of them didn't. But at some point, we went from being a two-room venue where I would play house and Tom would play funk and disco and soul and stuff to a one-room venue. And that was when we started DJing together. And it was from that moment on that we kind of started, you know, finding a point where the two things could meet. And so by the time we were doing that regularly, and Tim Lovely, who'd set up Tommy Touch Records, asked us to go off and make an album to promote the parties that we were now DJing at. When we did that, it was a kind of a fusion of where we both come from, and it's kind of remained that ever since. And since we've sort of got going, you know, Tom's got much more into house, and I've been introduced to you know, a whole sort of cupboard fulls of funk and soul that I wasn't aware of.
So let me get this right. You were both playing in separate rooms.
Mm.
One of you playing funk and disco, the other one of you playing house.
Mm.
And then after starting your own club night, and then you started playing together, and you were only encouraged to make an album to promote this club night that you had started.
Yeah, I mean, I think that my memory of it is slightly different, but only marginally, in the sense that I think that the first four or five 12s that we cut on Tummy Touch, which I've still got copies of, I think they were the ones that we were doing to promote the club night specifically. And then they actually did all right. And I very memorably remember, you know, once you hear another DJ playing one of your records for the first time in a nightclub, it's like the best thing ever. I remember my kind of, one of my DJing heroes, Andy alluded to him earlier, is a guy called Harvey, who's has a residency out in Ibiza and Pikes, and is one of the top of the great funk soul world DJs of our age, you know, DJ Harvey. And he was a guy who was probably 4 or 5 years older than me in Cambridge, and he was one that we all looked up to. We used to go and see him play in Brighton in the Zap Club, and we all wanted to be him, you know. And I remember, I think it was our second 12, was a track called 80-something, where Andy does a massive synth keyboard solo at the end, I remember. I remember him playing that in a club, and I think that was kind of that I could have just stopped making music then. Everything would have been fine. So everything else after that has just been a bonus. But I think then that we'd done those 4/5/12s on Tummy Touch, and Tim was like, come on, something's happening here. And he then packed us off to the countryside, to Ambleside in Lake District, and said, make a record. And this time, as I remember, Andy was super busy making all sorts of other music. So he was like, I've got a week, so we're going to do this album in a week. I was like, okay, let's give it a go. And so that first album, Northern Star, was completed in 1 week from start to finish.
No way. So which one of you chose Curtis Mayfield, Billy Jack?
That was me.
And why did you choose that? I mean, it's an incredible song, by the way. I listened beforehand and I was like, this is, I mean, for soul music, it's so incredible, and it definitely has that emotive connection. I was taken by it straight away.
All right, so, well, when we used to go to New York a fair bit and DJ at the Tunnel Club, and that was a lot of fun, as you can imagine, and absolutely part of that, sort of religious part of that experience was going to this record shop called A1 Records. That was what it was called, wasn't it, Tom?
It was. East 7th Street, still there, yeah.
There you go. And so, yeah, it's the best record shop in the world. And so, yeah, that was a tune. Like, I just liked Curtis Mayfield because I'd heard Move On Up, and that was a bit of a courtship tune for me, that one. And I didn't really know much more about him, and I just liked the sleeve. It's a brilliant sleeve. The album's called... There's No Place Like America Today.
Is this the one with the picture of the white family in the car and with exactly, a line of black people in front of it? Incredible, yeah. I was really
excited. Yeah. Yeah, that's it. So I just liked the sleeve, and I thought it was worth a punt given the Move On Up tune. It was as simple as that. And then when I first listened to that tune, it's just a perfect record. Like the groove, there's just so much space in the groove. It's the holes in the music are just amazing, so funky, and it's the perfect vocal, and the way it builds and the way that the horns come in and the way that develops, you know, it's just one of those records which is just faultless. And that's a sort of a reference point for me, since you can hear it in like, if you listen to sort of like the first half of Edge Hill, for example, that's got that kind of a bit of that feel to it. But it just became an absolute gold standard of music for me from the first time I heard it.
Well, we should listen to it. This is Curtis Mayfield, Billy Jack. Right, you guys, how long have you two, so you were both going to New York together to DJ?
I think so.
We were.
How long had you been together for this point? How long had you been DJing together?
This must have been like, it was the very beginning of the Jive Records era, so it must have been like 98, something like that. Probably year two or three, I guess.
Wow. You can definitely hear from these songs that you've chosen how they have influenced you guys. I mean, it's quite amazing, really. Let me take it back to your club night that you started. How easy was it to start that club night, and what was it like in a de rave? What was it like when you were there?
Yeah, I mean, it was not... I mean, we both of us, I think, had DJed quite a bit before then. I mean, I'd been DJing quite a bit in Manchester, and I'd played a couple of times in a Hacienda, which was amazing, and I was a resident at a place called Head Funk for a year. So we'd both DJed, and Andy had done loads of stuff himself up north and when he was at college. So, like Andy said, it was just hard to get the work when we came back into London with so much stuff going on. So they were more like, they were really parties to bring together just groups of friends, you know, and it was really were relying on our crowd to come. And then it kind of got a bit more ambitious, probably too ambitious. We're a bit like Icarus, you know, we sort of flew to the moon and got up to the sun and got burned quite badly. We set up a night. What was the name of that venue, Andy? For the Dave Seaman night?
It was the Gardening Club too.
So yeah, we overstretched ourselves that night, didn't we? And we lost a ton of money. We booked Dave Seaman, which for us at the time was like, particularly for Andy, I think it was a big deal, you know. And we slightly overstretched ourselves there, didn't we? We lost considerable amount of money then for ourselves in those days.
Considerable amount of money, that was the day after was the famous newspaper headline, because as we sort of had our fry up to see how we were going to plug the hole in the finances. The headline the back page of the tabloids was Seaman Sinks Armada, which was quite amusing. That was referring to a football game between England and Spain, but it was quite an appropriate headline.
All press is good press.
Yeah. And actually, in a weird sort of way, the good thing that came out of that was we realised that our future wasn't in club promotion. Although weirdly, like you say, we went back to then set up one of London's biggest festivals, but that came later. But that refocused our energies on wanting to write records and be DJs and to stay out of the organisational side of things, which is probably a good decision, you know?
Was it a difficult process going from DJing to writing? Or did that come naturally
I think Andy should answer that a bit more because he'd been writing. That's not untrue. I'd had one EP out with one band years ago, but I hadn't really committed much stuff to vinyl before I met Andy. So you'd had quite a lot of experience, Andy. You were remixing and writing and all sorts by then, weren't you?
Yeah, I'd had a couple of rave tunes out on a label called Rumour Records, and because I had a deal going in Wakefield where I grew up, where there was a rich kid whose dad had a snooker club, and his dad had bought him a recording studio. But he didn't know how to use any of it. So I had a deal with him where I would go down and help him write a tune. And then I got to use the studio for the rest of the night.
Right.
So using that deal, I'd managed to get a couple of tunes out on this Rumour Records thing, which is very exciting. And then I was living in a flat. When I met Tom, I was living in a flat in Clapham with two other lads. And we had a band called The Beat Foundation. And we've been doing some livey sort of, yeah, dancey livey gigs. And we'd had a tune on Pete Tong, in fact, which was massive. And then massive for us anyway. And then we were actually just in the process of signing a deal with Virgin when it all started happening for me and Tom. And it was a very difficult conversation with my flatmates, with whom I've been struggling with for years, saying, lads, I'm afraid I'm going to have to roll with this one. That was not fun.
So you had just got a record deal with your old band, with your other band, and you and Tom had just started DJing together, and it was all kicking off for you two as well, making music together.
Yeah, and it just felt like, there was just a vibe of me and Tom making the tune, because I think my first memory of making music together was it was all just a laugh, and to be honest, it's always remained that, in that Tom would come round with some records that he wanted to sample. I had a little basic setup in my bedroom in this flat in Clapham, so we'd mess about with that, and then we'd go out on the common and play a bit of football, because I'm shit and Tom's a really good football player, so we were having a kind of skill exchange. And that sort of spirit of just having a laugh and making music that we both think is great has remained the modus operandi ever since.
It's the best way to make music. When did you move down to London then? Did you move to London for uni?
94 for me.
And then what, the promoter? Was it the promoter that came up to you guys and told you you should make go away and make an album for it?
He was a guy called Tim Lee, who was called Tim Lovely, was his pseudonym. He's still out there. He's running a label called Tommy Touch. It's still going. But I was in a band in Cambridge called the Thumbsaurus People. He was in a band 2 years older than me called Bhagwan Fresh and the Gurus of Jive. And they were like my heroes. They were the guys I wanted to be. They used to wear caftans and play funk covers. They were brilliant. And then he set up this label in Shoreditch, which is unrecognisable from the Shoreditch you're in now, like a proper, like, you know, it's crawling in and out of strange brick walls and just a much madder, wilder place. He lived in this funny warehouse on Rivington Street, which is probably now almost certainly an estate agent, but at the time was anything but that. And he ran that label. There were some people called the Idiot Boys were signed to that. A lot of acts from my hometown, from Cambridge, signed to that label. And all doing all right. There was a label called Newphonic around that time that was in the same sort of lane. And he sort of showed some belief in us and sent us off packing. And really, it was that making that album, which was Northern Star, which he did in a week, which that was the one that had Out the River on it. And that was the one that it really happened really rapidly after that. Like, it's sort of, when I think about from making that record, you know, Andy says two years later, we were in the Tunnel Club, you know, as sort of guests, up and coming UK DJs, part of an American label. It was very sudden. And it really was probably Out the River that kind of, you know, broke the floodgates for us. You know, and that tune, and Rob the Bank, who was the editor of Music Magazine at the time, picked it up on that, pressed a few sevens. And it was, I guess in those days, it was a much simpler time. You know, there wasn't social media, there wasn't sort of SoundCloud or anything like that. So it wasn't, a lot of people didn't have access to technology the way they do now. So there was just less music about. And there's a small cabal, you know, of kind of A&R guys, and they were mainly guys, you know, who were signing records. So if you kind of knew the right people and you had some momentum, things could happen quite rapidly. So it happened really rapidly for us. We did that. We signed a label deal with Jive, like about 6 months later, went back into the studio, did Vertigo, which is our first sort of album that people are really aware of, which, and that's why I had ICU Baby on it, and If Ever at the Same. And then we were in that summer, after that we were in Ibiza, and then everything starts, you know, and then from there on in, it's like
that,
it's
really quick,
really rapid. Yeah, so ICU Baby was written basically in the basement of Manumission, full of all these strippers, and it was a woman called Grandma Funk who was the hostess with the mostest, who was, me and Andy used to DJ, and she'd get on the mic and do her bit, and that was her one night who started singing the ICU Baby lyrics. So everything happened really suddenly, and I guess we were quite good at, I think there's a lot of madness in that time, and a lot of it is about the people who were probably just about able to keep their shit together enough to kind of to actually get some stuff down are the ones that survived, you know. And I think we were like, when we were in Manumission, we were having a great time, don't get me wrong, but I think we were like, this is happening, we need to get back to studio, get this recorded, there's something happening here. And there's a lot of people that didn't quite have the self-control to get that stuff down, you know.
Right, I see. I can imagine. The drugs were much better back in the day, so I can see why.
Yeah.
From what I've heard, anyway, that's really fascinating that you say that, because from what I've heard you talk about is that there are actually quite a lot of record deals going on. I mean, Andy was having about five different record deals by the sounds of things going on. and as you said, Tom, like, a lot of people from Cambridge had been signed and all of that. Like, from my perspective, obviously, where I've come up from, you know, if you weren't in London, you didn't have much of a chance of getting a record deal. And it's fascinating that you say, actually, technology and being able to produce from your bedroom and do all that shit, like, that has actually made it a lot harder and saturated the market so much that people just don't get much notice, or you have to have a very, you know, it has to be fucking on TikTok with a million, 3 million streams or whatever. That's really fascinating that you talk about that. What do you think it was with At the River that kind of did all that for you?
Zoe Ball, mainly, I think. Bless her. It was Zoe Ball who was doing the breakfast show on Radio 1 at the time. I don't know. Oh, I think she presumably listened to it because there was a front cover of Music Magazine back in the days when magazines were, you know,
still a thing as well.
They're still a thing, yeah. So maybe that's why she listened to it. Anyway, she loved it. I think it went on to be a quite a big tune at her wedding to Norm. And she played it because they'd said that it was too slow for the radio, and but she kept playing it anyway. And then the response from the listeners was so positive that they eventually agreed to reconsider the playlist decision. But then there was a whole battle because they wanted to take the trombone out, and obviously without the trombone out, it's just a loop. So then we had to sort of fight that one. And anyway, eventually it ended up as part of the daytime playlist, which was quite amazing, really, considering what an odd tune it is. It's kind of a tribute to Radio 1 that eventually found its way on there.
Wow. I mean, I will talk about the river in a sec, but it's mad to me that over this podcast series, it's crazy to think how Firstly, I mean, it doesn't surprise me that Radio tried to A&R your record for you and tell you which part to. I don't know what is Radio's problem, but they're Radio. They play records. They're not A&Rs. We've got enough fucking A&Rs in the world to keep us all from questioning what kind of frigging beat it is, what frequency is on the hi-hat, whatever. It annoys me that Radio has that sort of power, and fucking fair play to you guys for sticking to your guns with that. Because I kind of think without the trombone, it's half a song, right? So incredible that you guys pushed forward to it. I do feel like, and in a sense, that was kind of like a modern model where the track gained traction due to Zoe Ball playing it on her radio station, and then it getting onto Radio 1 playlist, and then having that crowd reaction. That's typically kind of how it works with Spotify and stuff, right? So interesting with that. The reason why I picked At the River for my track is not only because when I was on tour with Pete Tong doing the Ibiza Classics, this song wasn't in the first year, and I don't think it was in the third year, but it was in the second year that I did the Classics with the Heritage Orchestra and Pete. And it was actually my favourite part of the set, because even though it was a little bit slower, people were still like, it was still a very euphoric thing for a lot of people. I also have earlier memories. What year was this released, by the way, out of interest?
Oh, good question.
97, I think.
Right.
Yeah, it sounds about right.
So I remember going on holiday with my parents and being in the back of the car. I don't know how old I was, but I remember, like, the memory makes me feel quite young. Mm. And I remember this song being played on the way to the seaside. Mm. I am going to shut up and play this because I can't wait to hear it. This is Groove Armada, At the River. I think what I love the most as well is that plodding bass.
Yeah.
It's very smooth but very clumsy in a way, what I like about it. How did you put all of that together? How did it come around? Tell me.
The only thing I was going to say about it, I'll pan over to Andy because he played the trombone, but I was going to say that thing about technology I was talking about earlier. I think the lovely thing about At the River is that it came out of the fact that we were in the middle of the Lake District and we just didn't have anything with us, really. We'd brought one sampler and one keyboard. We didn't even have a microphone. So I'll let Andy tell you about that because he actually worked out how to play it. So so there's something about sometimes just forcing yourself to make music when you don't have too many choices, you know, where you just have to make stuff work. And out of that, I think you kind of end up with strange collisions of things, you know, like a weird 50s vocal, because you've got to make that work with that one bass sound you've got, which is the Nord. And then Andy had his trombone, so you make that work. And somehow, you know, if you had all the choices in front of you in the studio, you probably wouldn't have stuck a sample of Patti Page with the trombone. So there's something about sometimes when you're writing music, not having choice, you know, and limiting yourself and forcing yourself to make strange compromises and weird decisions. And I think that really benefits from that one. But I'll hand over to Andy, who played the trombone and also had the technology to turn a speaker into a microphone.
Great segue, Tom.
Thank you, Darren.
All tunes are obviously incredibly random because they're always the product of a moment in time, which was in itself incredibly unlikely to have happened, you know. But the ingredients of this one definitely fit that, insofar as it was quite near the end of the week that we had in this place. And I think it was the last trip down to the village store to get, what was that beer we were drinking all the time? Boddington's.
Yeah.
And these terrible waffle things. It was basically the Boddington's and the waffle shop. And and on the counter, they had a load of CDs for 50p. And at the top of this pile was Sounds of the 50s. And it was 50p. And so it was like, just like stick it with the beers. There might be a sample on there. And that's what had the Patti Page tune on. And the first thought listening to that was just what nice chords they were. So they're whacking the computer to try and work out what the chords are because it sounded nice. And then it actually sounded quite nice just leaving the loop in there with the chords. And then I had my trombone because I was still earning money sort of doing the odd jazz gig and I had to practice. And so I was just practicing over the top of these chords that we got going, playing the old standard blues stuff, and it sounded quite nice. And as Tom said, there was no microphone. And my old physics teacher at school did a thing once which has stuck with me where microphone turns movements of air into electricity and the speaker does the reverse. And so if you reverse the wires, you can make one do the other, or you get what I'm saying.
Wow, techie as fuck, man.
Well, it's basically sounds like it, but it involved taking the two wires of the speaker and sellotaping it onto the guitar lead, and it worked. And so that's allowed us to record the trombone. And in passing, it just happened that the particular sort of crap hi-fi that the cottage happened to have gave it a sort of old Louis Armstrong kind of sound, which didn't hurt.
Oh my god!
And that was that. But then when we put it all together, as Tom said, massively helped by the fact that you got one bass noise, a couple of pad sounds, and that's it. And you've got about 7 seconds of sampling time. And you just avoid all that, what my dad would call paralysis through analysis, where you've just got 1,000 choices or 10,000 choices for every sound, which is a real plague, I think, of all the obvious upsides of Ableton Logic and everything. It's too many damn choices. So we didn't have that. But when all these things came together, we did kind of realise that it was a good tune, because I remember for some reason we were in individual cars, and when we set off back to London, we ran off a second DAT tape copy. I wouldn't imagine, you can Google what a DAT tape is when we finished.
Yeah, I've had these. Zinc taught me that. So I've had that conversation about DAT tapes already. So you recorded your DAT tape.
And then we took one each back to London in case one of us had a crash. So there was a recognition that it was a good tune.
So really a happy accident more than anything.
Yeah. And actually then, oddly, when I was then taking that DAT to a record shop, a place to get the first 7-inch cut, I did have a crash. So we were right in thinking that. Something drove right up my bum just on the way in. I had quite a bad crash. But I still managed to get the 7-inch cut, so that was all good. But yeah.
It is fucking wild how precious tunes were back then. That if you were the only person with a copy of that tune.
That's it, yeah.
You know, it's not a case of, oh, I've just saved it to my hard drive and I've saved it to my computer. So if anyone steals this, I've got that on my computer. It was a real, you had to guard that like it was your child.
Yeah.
That's mental. And the weight within a song as well.
Mm.
Fascinating stuff. So it was released in 97 and a hit in 99, took 2 years. What happened in those 2 years?
Well, it was sort of a hit when it was first released, in the sense we're talking about that, like the 7-inch came out, did 500 copies, they sold out, then we did another 500 and they went, and then Rob picked up on it. And that was the thing that led to our deal. That's why we got the deal with Jive, really, was the back of that 7-inch. We were offered a couple of other deals at the time, but they were the ones that we just wanted to go with. They were the ones that believed in us as an album act, you know. And then, it was finally released up properly with the weight of a record label behind it. And it became a hit. I'm not sure, was that the first single or Vertigo? I'm not sure it was. I feel like maybe if everyone...
I See You Baby
was the...
Oh, no, if everyone looked the same, you're right.
Yeah, yeah. It was everyone looked the same. Because we wrote, when we did Vertigo, we wrote an album that basically sounded like 12 At The Rivers. Not as good at At The River, but lots of down-tempo stuff. And our A&R man, a guy called Scott McLaughlin, and he was right to do this. basically sent us back into the studio. This was post our hedonistic summer in Ibiza, and said, you know, this was the era of what I guess you were calling big beat, you know, that whole big beat sound where Norman was, you know, Fatboy Slim was in his absolute preeminence. And they were like, you need a bit of that on your record. So we went back in and we wrote If Ever Look the Same and ICU Baby, which is probably a wise decision to do those, because they were the ones that kind of opened the doors for us. And then At the River came in as the third single on that record. And by that time, people were, you know, the radio was on board with us and were supporting us.
You also had a massive car sync, didn't you?
Yes.
If I remember, because I See You Baby, I remember that tune. I think it was the Fatboy Slim remix.
Yeah.
But that's what I remember that advert prominently in my mind because of that tune.
Yeah, and I've never been, it's one of those complicated things. I think when it comes down to having your music used in a commercial way, whether that's films or adverts, I think you either say yes to like most things, or you just, or like you're like Prince or whatever, and you just say no to, or Massive Attack and you say no to everything. And but for us, the sync stuff has worked really well. I mean, financially, obviously, but actually in terms of bringing our music to a wider audience, you know, it's been really helpful for us, whether it's like, you know, a big Richie Havens track we had on a film called Collateral, which brought me, which would be a track called Hands of Time, which would never have been picked up, or like that one, which was the, I won't mention the brand, but it was definitely a French car maker with a fat bottom car, hence the ad, you know. And they were helpful for us financially and allowed us to do things with the live band that we wouldn't be able to do, but actually really helped, you know, people become more aware of us as a band. So I have no shame in taking the corporate dollar.
Is it so? From that conversation, then I'm guessing commercial success is nice, but not necessarily why you do any of this at all.
I think if that would have been the be all and end all, we would have charted a very different path, you know, because when ICU Baby was a hit, obviously what people want is another tune that sounds like that, or when Super Starling was a hit, what people want is another tune that sounds like that. And and you know, in terms of making money, when you're flavour of the month and you can play on the big stage as a dance act, if it's just the two of you and a few machines, then you can definitely make some money. If you do if you do it with a live band, which requires a total crew of 25 people, you don't.
No.
We didn't make any sort of strategic financial decisions ever, but I don't regret that for one second, not least because, you know, we sort of had, we starved, we're fine. And but you know, the live thing, for example, that really became a defining thing for us as a band, yeah, but also personally, I think, you know, as people, the 15 years that we spent with that group of people, the band and the crew, which remained pretty much constant throughout all that time. We had quite a sort of communist approach to the setup, and that was just magical. That's stuff that you just no money can buy. And so that was, you know, at the end of the day, what's it all about, really? You know, I wouldn't have changed that for the world.
Well, when you're on tour with a group of people who all love the music they're playing, who all love the people that are making the music, and it feels like you're on some special journey together and creating these incredible vibes and atmospheres for crowds all around the world. I mean, there isn't much that comes close to that. And if you guys have had 15 years of that, then how amazing must that feel?
And it is amazing. And then some of the moments when I look back on it now, you know, incredible things of closing the second stage and Glastonbury and, you know, John Peel when we came back with Black Light, and so many amazing gigs, like doing five nights stand in a place called the Horden Pavilion in Sydney, same thing in Brixton, and headlining stages around the world. That's all been amazing. And it has been the most extraordinary thing. It's also been the most physically, emotionally demanding thing as well. You know, like there are times, I remember there's a story, we played a thing called Big Day Out, a festival in Australia. I'm not sure if it's even going anymore, but it was a massive big Australian festival. And the big gig was to sort of close the boiler room in there. And you go in there and find like 20,000 people, this massive room. And I sort of remember standing side of stage just before one thing, this promoter just came up to me and just going, "Don't fuck it up." And I just thought, oh, fucking great. That's great timing, you know, just before I go on. And there was a lot of that stuff as well. You thinking to yourself, that exact phrase, "Don't fuck it up." And always, so it's great, but that pressure is always there in the back of your mind, you know, and always wanting to do better and always driving yourself on to kind of make the gig as good as you can. So it's absolutely brilliant, but it's totally exhausting at the same time, you know. And anyone who's been on those kind of runs knows how much how much you get out of it, but how much it takes from you as well, you know?
Yeah, because I always feel like you put that pressure upon yourself that if it isn't perfect, of course, everybody's got their eyes on you. But, you know, I've been to many raves where, you know, I've even seen Andy C not beat match correctly.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm there going, he missed out on that. But nobody else knows.
No.
And I feel like, you know, there's a lot of emotional pressure that you put on yourself that if your show isn't the best that you think it can possibly be, then that also takes a lot out of you as well.
Yeah.
I can see that. I wanted to go back to Ibiza because you mentioned this whole, you got your record deal and then from there, it went from 0 to 100 and all of a sudden you were playing in Ibiza. Where did you start out in Ibiza? What was that first summer like? And did you come out? Did you come out anxious and depressed shells of yourselves?
I definitely did. Andy started a little bit before me, and then my first trip was a few years later, wasn't it? I mean, you were out. When did you first go, mate?
I went in '89 as a youngster because my cousin was a DJ. He'd set up a free party thing called DIY, a Nottingham based sort of free party collective, and they were playing over there, so I sort of tagged along. And then I had this with the Beat Foundation we were talking about earlier. We had another trip down there where we were promised a gig in Amnesia, or a season of gigs in Amnesia. We drove down to Ibiza in a post office van to do these gigs, and when we got there, there were no gigs, and we were literally stealing from supermarkets. I can say that now, probably in safety, to feed ourselves. And eventually managed to borrow £100 off a stranger to buy the diesel to drive back to the UK again, and had to cry our way onto the ferry because our ticket had expired. So that wasn't a brilliant trip, although it did involve a cast of colourful people. But then the first sort of proper thing, summer, you know, as a DJ, it couldn't have really been better. It was when Manumission was in full swing. We were residents there for a while, and we stayed in the Manumission Motel, which is sadly is no more. It didn't last very long, actually, but that was like when people think of Ibiza and what it stands for, that's what it is, or that's what it was, insofar as it was, you know, a coming together of like total nutters and mavericks in a situation where anything feels possible and is, but without any aggression or bullshit, and totally lawless. And that didn't last for that long, but what it did, it was a lot of fun.
So you guys play often at Space, right? If I'm correct.
You weren't
residents there, but you were regulars at there, right?
We were practically residents at We Love, you know, for a long time. We would play what was still at that time an outdoor terrace, you know, for
we
the
love
first
Sundays,
few years.
Right?
Yeah, and that was amazing. That was probably until very recently. I mean, we've been doing this gig recently, and obviously nothing's happened this summer, but we've been playing in this lovely little outside stage at Ushuaia the last few years. So I've really enjoyed it. I love playing outdoors in Ibiza. I think that's something magical about that. You know, it's obviously you can do it in the UK, but it's normally raining. But there's something about, you know, an alfresco club experience in Ibiza that was magic. So that We Love period was really, really amazing, actually. I had a great time there. And it just, you know, the acoustics are always great, and the people you work with are great. You know, the vibe is always good. And just lots of great records coming out at that time as well. So just really fun to be DJing music you genuinely loved, surrounded by people that you at that time you thought you genuinely loved. I'm not sure if we really did, but you know what I mean. But it was a great vibe about the whole thing. Yeah.
Do you still think that? Because I asked Pete this, and because when I first went to Ibiza, there was a lot of wankers Instagramming their mates shuffling. There was the girls in the tiny little outfits, and you know, and the boys with their tops off, and you know, and they'd done pills that make them mong out too much, and you know, do you still think there's that vibe there, even with the VIP culture? But like, do you still feel like there's that special rave scene over in Ibiza that is still just as good to this day?
I mean, from my own point of view, I've, like I say, last couple of years playing in that little slot that we do in Ushuaia, which is not the main slot, so it's sort of 6 till 8 o'clock as the sun's coming down, and you can play more interesting house music than the stuff you have to do when you're on a big stage, you know. So mm-hmm. you play stuff that's got a bit of a wiggle and a groove. And I think the vibe you get out there is lovely. You know, like it's a really, you know, it's probably, it is unlike many other clubbing experience I have. But so from a personal point of view, I still, even now, you know, I've really missed it this summer. I still get a real tingle when the wheels touch down on the tarmac. You know, I really do. And it still does it for me. And there's lots of people we know that are still out there, and there's restaurants that I love to eat in. I can still feel the magic of that experience. But I mean, obviously it's diminished for all sorts of reasons for us personally. But I don't know. What do you think, Andy?
Yeah, I still, you know, get the same thing, you know, 25, whatever it is, years on. When the plane touches down in Ibiza, it still feels like you're going into a world where, you know, you've still got that kind of, you know, anything might happen feeling about things, you know, which is great. And it is a bit of a sort of pleasure palace, you know, as you say. It might be more based around where you have a nice cold beer and a bit of food these days than the after party. But still, whatever floats your boat, really. But I do think that, on the other hand, you know, it's very, very difficult, you know, how many times we've got to go around the same circle of people who are nearer 15 and 18 saying it was better when I was young, you know. I mean, you've got to be mindful of that. But I do think that phones have meant, obviously, they're handy and all the rest of it, but they have fundamentally changed things. And I think some pretty negative ways, because as you were saying just then, this whole obsession with appearance on the one hand and with celebrity on the other, and you put those two things together and it's kind of removed a whole strand of the magic, which whether they're free parties in the UK or in Ibiza, it's like when you went there, you were off radar, you know. It's just like it was total freedom to go wherever you want, do whatever you want, go on whatever mission you want. And the fact that you've got this thing and people are taking photos and videos all the time and you need to Instagram to prove you're there and all that sort of stuff. I think that more than the music changes, things change, but that more than anything, and not just in this sort of realm, but everywhere, has been the thing which has changed culture and youth culture forever, really. And it is what it is. And, you know, maybe some people like it more, some people like it less, but it's definitely different.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow, interesting. Nobody's actually said it as poignantly as that. And I feel like a lot of guests I've had on have always wanted to skirt around that slightly. But that's exactly how I feel. And that's made me quite sad, really. I've generally gone raving to drum and bass. Over my time in my career, I've been to a lot of other different raves, just by the nature of the songs that I've featured on. And especially with online, there's the good side of it where you can actually find out more music and check the latest bootleg or the freshest double drop or whatever through somebody filming it on their phone. But almost, you know, that Ibiza culture, as you say, of if I don't put it on Instagram, it's not real. That for me has changed the landscape of raves slightly, and it's really interesting to hear you talk about that. And thank you for that, for your honesty with that. Let's take it back to a time when there was no phones. Who chose Last Rhythm by Last Rhythm?
That's Andy.
That was me again. I don't know how I got two of the three there. That's intentional.
Why did you choose Last Rhythm?
Just because, I mean, it could have been a few different ones, actually, but that's the one that always comes to mind when I think of, like, you know, my whole life has been determined by house music. And when I think of those moments in the kind of formative years between sort of like 17 and 21, where, you have those moments of like utter perfection, generally at sunrise, where nothing can be better in the best of all possible worlds. And the tune that comes to mind when I see the kind of collage of those images in my mind is that one. And so whenever I hear it now, whenever it comes on now and again on some old classics thing or whatever, it's almost like it almost brings me to tears. Not necessarily in a negative way, but it's got so many memories loaded into that tune of those kind of feelings that it's almost hard to listen to, although I suppose you're about to play it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So if you could just switch off your audio for this one, Andy. This is Last Rhythm by Last Rhythm. I want to know all about Lovebox. What made you start that up? How have you so casually forgotten about it? And why did you start that up in the first place?
It was a brand. I mean, there's an album, I can't remember, our fifth album or fourth album, I think, called Lovebox. And it was a really odd time for us. We'd basically been dropped by the label without them actually getting around to telling us. They just stopped supporting us on that record. And we were touring it. And we were going into like literally doing gigs in like Sheffield, and there were no records in any of the shops. And we were just feeling a bit abandoned, really. And we liked the record, and there's some great tracks on that record. And then, so we were a bit of a low ebb, I think, at that point. We were probably both of us mulling over the idea of packing it in, to be honest, the whole thing. It just felt like there wasn't, you know, there just wasn't enough support for us. Felt quite lonely out there. And then somebody, a guy called Ross Clark, told us that, had a site for a festival for a one day. It was the weekend of Glastonbury. So we were like, well, this is madness. It's never going to work, but let's do it, you know. So we put on a gig to, you know, ostensibly play that album in Clapham, called it Lovebox. Sold 20,000 tickets in an hour. I mean, it sold out overnight. It was like bonkers, which obviously gave us a lot, you know, renewed self-belief that there was still an interest in what we did, particularly the live stuff. And we put Norman Jay, and we put Tim Lovely and me and Andy, then the band played. And we just sort of stuck at it, really, and through thick and thin and tried to build it. And then we moved it to Victoria Park. We were sort of headlining the event every year, which was sort of good in some ways because, you know, it's nice to play your own parties. But it meant that we never, you know, we could have been playing, I don't know, whatever big London festivals were going on then and making a ton of money, but we didn't. We just lost loads of money on our own festival. But the experience of walking around that festival, you know, with 25,000 people there, and me walking around and how I felt about it, no one knowing, because no one ever recognises me. They recognise Andy quite a lot because he's so tall, but they never recognise me. So I can walk around incognito at our own gigs, let alone our own festival, and just watching people just enjoying themselves. And, you know, we were quite early on in bringing Horse Meat Disco. We had a big gay Sunday, and we were really proud to play a part in that side of things in London culture. And all those contributions we made, amazing, and being part of that was enormous, you know, gave me enormous sense of pride, you know. And then, like all these things do, Money Men got involved, and they weren't very nice people and didn't really want to be around that culture. And an opportunity came to sort of be bought out, and we took it. And I'm really relieved because it caused me loads of emotional stress. And, you know, the bits I loved about it were the kind of, you know, that when the party starts and you're just watching people having a good time. And I loved headlining my own party. That was amazing. But I didn't love conversations with agents, and I didn't love trying to tell people this is a festival their band should be playing. They just wanted to know how much money they were going to get paid. And I found that stuff quite soul destroying, that business end of the industry, which is quite grueling, you know, and I haven't had much experience of that. So I'm enormously proud of it. And it was a great thing to be involved with, and enormous amount of pride. But it ended in a way that I would rather it hadn't, you know. And there were people that became involved in that business who remain nameless, who I don't wish well, it has to be said. But they're not part of my life anymore, so that's all good.
Andy, how do you feel about Lovebox? Is it a similar sort of situation with you?
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was, as Tom said, it was totally unplanned beginnings, but it was, it was quite mad when you find yourself on the right side of 20,000 ticket sales, which is great, but then it's like, okay, where do you hire toilets? Where do you hire fences? You know, all the kind of minutiae I was trying to put on some of that scale. And it did, you know, had moments of absolute, timeless kind of joy, really, where you're standing on the main stage having headlined your own thing. And towards the end, there were 60 or 70,000 people across the weekend coming into this thing and having the time of their lives. And you're standing at the heart of that with basically just a group of mates holding the whole thing together. They were amazing moments, you know, but as you get bigger, of course, you attract more and more attention, not all of it pleasant. And towards the end, it became quite a struggle, particularly for Tom, actually. He was more in the thick of this struggle than I was, but it became quite a struggle. And so you have a tendency to sort of remember that and all the magical bit that preceded it. Mm. But as time passes, hopefully we can get them focused more on the magic.
Did it remind you guys of when you would put on your own parties back in the day?
In the early days, 100%, you know, because there were loads of friends around us, you know, like loads of our mates who were in clubbing, you know, promoters we knew we were bringing in, like Andy mentioned, his cousin Rick from DIY and all these guys, they were doing the artwork and guys and gals and lots of good friends around us. Those early days when it wasn't about the business of music were really lovely. And it's funny, it's like when we started Lovebox, there were no festivals in cities. Like it wasn't like the idea that you could put a festival on in the centre of London, there weren't that. Like, so I'm proud of that stuff. I'm proud that we thought, no, look, you know, we'd come back from Glastonbury, we were super Glastonbury heads, loved it. And we were like, how do we bottle some of the experiences of Glastonbury that we love, and how do we pop that into Hackney? How do we make that happen? And that stuff I'm really proud of. And we managed to have, you know, those bits of chaos, even from, you know, 12 till 11 o'clock at night, we'd get that, you know, Las Vegas were involved at times, Horse Meat Disco I mentioned, you know, one year we had Dizzy Rascal headline the Friday, Roxy Music on a Saturday, and Grace Jones on a Sunday. You know, I look at that poster, some of all my heroes, you know, and to put that together, And not to have compromised our ideals, you know, and to put people like Roxy Music on a Saturday night was, you know, people like, that's not going to work. And it sort of did work, really. And then we went on to work with Brian Ferry. So that really worked, you know, so that was great. So, yeah, those bits are amazing. It was just the tail end of it when you're feeling under pressure to make money. And so you make artistic choices, a bit like Pete was, you know, I was mentioning on your podcast listening earlier, you feel that pressure. Once you get away from doing the things you love, you're at risk, you know, because then you book things for money, but you don't really believe in them. And so if they don't work, then you just lost a ton of money and you hate yourself. And again, I could name a couple of artists in particular, which I will not name because they're nice people, but where that sort of thing happened, and that wasn't great, being around that, booking people for way too much money and they're not delivering, you know.
Yeah, I've got to say, I played Lovebox with Rudimental back in 2014, I think it was. And I remember walking through the gates and seeing the ticket offices and thinking, I'm in fucking London. I'm in London. This is mental.
Yeah.
And the size of the stages and the scale of the entire festival was so impressive. Mm. And I actually didn't know that you guys put on, that Lovebox came from you guys.
Yeah.
So it's mad to hear that it's kind of like the early promoter days that you tried to do first time round on 50 times bigger scale and 50 times more successful. Mm. But it's a shame. Do you think that corporations and businesses, so example for the VIP table business in Ibiza, do you think that sort of corporation financial side of things is ruining rave?
I mean, personally, I think it's mixed, because the thing you're talking about, like that, your experience at Lovebox in 2014, we were long gone from them. That was taken over by Live Nation. I have to say, I've got no beef with them. I think they do a great job. You know, they've got good people to work for, and they've got real music heads to book the acts. You know, they're involved with Glastonbury. So, what, you know, if you work with the right people, there's some really talented, passionate people within the business end of music totally, but you've got to pick the right ones. And you're right that on Ibiza, the kind of the corporate side of things, and the, you know, it's the thing that pays the bills for people. That's the reality. That it's the it's the VIP tables that actually pay the bills. But what you mustn't forget is it's the kids on the dance floor that make the whole thing happen. And if you start making life impossible for them, then the whole thing, the whole operation falls apart, you know.
Interesting. All right, let me play the last song. Tom, I'm guessing this one's your choice, or has Andy taken all three?
I feel badly, yeah, because I've done all the talking for the last 5 minutes. But yeah, this is...
it's all right.
Is it When You Were Mine?
It's the Prince one, yeah. Can you tell me a bit about this?
Yeah, I mean, this is, for me, is like my moment. You know, I was quite into like... I was into the Smiths and the Wedding Present and indie, really, when I was a teenager. And then really it was this record, which I think the album is called Dirty Minds. And it cover, if you don't know, is sort of Prince in, it's black and white. And Prince has got this sort of open jacket on and a pair of black, very tight briefs. And I must have been about 14, 15. I was like, whoa, what is this? I had never seen anything like it and I'd never heard anything like it. And it's sort of, you know, it's very minimalist. It's sort of, like, it's Prince playing funk. You know, it's very stripped back. It's less, it's my, you know, you can hear him jamming with his band. And yeah, this is what got me into wanting to be involved with dance music in its broadest sense. You know, this is the album that changed everything for me, really. And this track is, I could listen to this track. This would be my Desert Island disc, you know, this would be the one that I would take with me. It's amazing.
It's an incredible song, actually. I listened before and it was very, very vibey.
Yeah.
This is When You Were Mine by Prince. Incredible artist.
Yeah, amazing.
So I'm going to bring it a bit more up to date now. So you are releasing your 9th studio album, aren't you?
Yeah, I think so.
And you've had numerous Brit and Grammy nominations, which is incredible, because I think that's what all artists, definitely how I feel, like I won't stop until I get a fucking Brit Award, and I don't know how long it's going to take me, but I will eventually get there one day, please. But all of that kind of critically acclaimed stuff, you know, what keeps you going now? What keeps you excited? What keeps you guys, you know, in love with each other and so forth? And I'll give that one to Andy.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's just a very, very similar to how it was in my flat in Clapham and whenever it was, you know. It's like when we decided to do this, because we have not made an album for a long time, 10 years or so, a bit less than that, something like that. But when we decided to do this one, which came off the back of doing a few small live gigs. When was it? I'm losing track of the years now because this last year that we've got, last year I think it was,
yeah.
And we, a particular one in particular in the Warehouse project in Manchester, which is sort of the end of this little run of smaller vibey gigs. Just we did simply for the fun of it to get the old crew together, you know, one last time, and it just felt great, and that kindled up a bit of digging around in the sort of cutting room floor. Tapes of the Black Light album, which is our previous one, and as soon as we started listening to bits and getting excited about ideas, it just rekindled that thing really, where get the two of us in a room, is 100% focused on making tunes, and it's just a real laugh, you know. And when we go at it, we do go at it. Not least now because I live in France and Tom lives in London, so this album was made in a series of properly intense, like not far off 24-hour sessions, you know, old school, and in Tom's basement. But it's just that the 100% focus, like, you know, we've all got lots of shit going on in our lives, but right now we're just doing this, and there's plenty of beers in the fridge, and we can turn it up nice and loud, and it's just a laugh, you know, and there's no agenda, and we're just going to make whatever kind of tune we want to hear. What actually came out, tellingly, I suppose, was a kind of tribute to the blue-eyed soul sound that was for so many years the tour bus party soundtrack. And we kind of made our own version of the tour bus party soundtrack.
No way. So is that what kind of influenced you for this album then? Is this what kind of drives you forward with kind of musical influences? Or have you actually looked at the landscape of music nowadays to make new music?
Yeah, I think that did drive us forward. I think that we, I'm very aware of what's happening now, and I'm a real neophyte. I'm always digging new stuff, and I'm excited about that. But I felt like this album, we were very much in our own lane, you know, just doing what, like Andy said, you know, I think we felt that, like Andy said, we'd done the gig, and that felt really special. And then the Manchester gig, where I felt particularly special. And then, I think it was just really fun to be in the basement again making music. So we just made slightly selfishly amazing music for ourselves, really, and stuff we wanted to enjoy. We didn't have a record deal when we were doing it, so there was no sort of pressure. There was no sense of what the audience was even, you know. So it was just, make these tunes, some of which were things that we probably should never have left behind on the last record, and other ones which were new bits. But, there was that blue-eyed soul kind of easier sort of sound that we did on this record. It's a dance record in some ways, but it's a bit like Andy said, it's got that slightly blue-eyed soul, almost the bits of Hall & Oates almost in some of the tracks, you know.
Yeah, I listened through actually, and I was quite surprised at how there was a lot of actual kind of songs on there in a typical song format, rather than a dance album sort of thing. There are definitely hints of that, but how exciting to kind of push forward that whole genre still after this long. My final question then, how do you think audiences have changed? Are you looking forward to playing this? Are you looking forward to playing this new album out to a whole new audience?
It's really, right.
So I think it's going to be.
You go, mate.
Sorry, mate, go on.
I was only going to say one thing, was just because I'm up here. I'm up here with a few friends on holiday at the moment. So I've been showing off a picture of our last show, which is a great picture from us at Boomtown last summer. And that was another one of those gigs where you just think, wow, God, maybe, you know, there's still a lot of credit in the bank there, you know. And we played this festival, which is an amazing festival. It's a real vibey thing. It's this Natural Amphitheatre in Winchester. There must have been 40,000 people there. And the audiences didn't feel that different to me then. It felt great, you know, playing again. And I think there's something about live music particularly, which, you know, is just... And it's one thing we all need to get back to as soon as we possibly can, because there's a real magic in that. And it is timeless, that connection with people. So for me, I wouldn't have said that it was an amazing gig, that one at Boomtown, and one I really cherish. And even though we closed Glastonbury 10 years ago, this one felt just as good for me. You know, I felt just as excited to be up on stage and for people to be appreciating the music we'd written. It felt really extraordinary for that specific memory of that gig. But sorry, Anne, I've interrupted you twice, so I'll let you say something.
No, I was going to say exactly the same thing. I was going to just talk about Boomtown and how, you know, it was this massive stage, as Tom said, with a sort of 40,000 person capacity. It was empty all day long. There was just some bands playing some sort of nice reggae and stuff, but there was no one there. And it was a really young crowd, and it was a DJ-led festival, and all the DJ shit was in this amazing, like, you know, Ruins of New York type set that was built, but a long way away. So this stage was a destination venue. You know, you're never going to walk past it. And so I hadn't even dared to look round the curtain before we walked on stage. And we walked on stage, it was one of the most memorable views of my life, you know. So
wow.
I think it does... feel that, you know, as soon as we can turn it up again, start playing music again, it feels that this thing that we do of playing dance music with a band, and that combination of kind of heaviness and uppiness, which has kind of become our signature, still feels like it's relevant. So if people are up for it, then so are we.
Tom and Andy, thank you so much for joining me. It has been a pleasure to talk to the legends that are Groove Armada. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Becky.
Thanks for having us.
The Art of Rave is presented and written by me, Becky Hill. It is a Strawberry Blonde production for my record label, Echo Records.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.